We'll call the meeting to order. And I see that Chancellor McCormick is here too, so, you know, maybe the way to settle this and save ourselves a lot of headaches on the this whole committee is, Chancellor, if you want to come up, you and Brunix arm wrestle, and whoever wins gets most of the money. Can we do it that way?
Representative Rukavina, and I'm already here.
Yeah.
We can have a meeting first and decide how we want to come out.
And I can be the referee.
We'll be happy to make the deal.
That's right. You can be the referee, Representative. Representative Detmer, were you done with your question yesterday when we adjourned?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay. Representative Norton. Welcome back, President.
Great pleasure to be here.
Representative Norton, remember, Norness, I thought. Was it Norness?
There's a fair amount of
looking at you and telling you. Well, Representative Walty, do you want to ask Representative Norton's question? Do you know what it was? Was it something on the mail? It wasn't. Okay. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And President Brunix, I just wanted to ask you something about the Hormel Institute, because that's located in the city that I represent, the city of Austin, and I'm not sure that people are familiar with it, and I know that they do a substantial amount of research, and probably gain some of those research dollars that you've talked about here, and I just wanted to kind of find out what the relationship is between the Hormel Institute and the University of Minnesota, and if you could just maybe give a little bit of a description if you have some time to be able to do that. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Poppy, we were together at the dedication of a new building, a new expansion of the research building on the Hormel Institute site. Actually, the Hormel Institute started in 1942. I won't give you all the history that transpired in the ensuing years, but I will say it is now one of the leading centers in the country and has actually been a leading center of research on nutrition over many, many years. And so this partnership developed in 1942 between the Hormel Foundation, a charitable foundation, and the University of Minnesota. And now this this institute is dedicated primarily to cancer prevention and cancer treatment using chemical compounds and other compounds that are extracted from natural foods. For example, there's some interesting research going on related to an extract that comes from green tea, just to name one thing. Well, over the years, the research focus has changed. But this is a little known fact, but Hormel now is one of the leading centers of research in the state. We now have what I think is going to be a strong partnership between the Twin Cities campus, mostly Hormel Institute and the Mayo Clinic, and it will focus primarily on cancer prevention and treatment. Over the last several years, the Hormel Institute is, and its faculty under Dr. Zigong Rong has been really successful in competing for National Institutes of Health grants. I think last year they competed for and received something like $12 million, which I think is a phenomenal achievement. And it is now getting to be quite well known, not just in the United States, but around the world. And we're now setting out with funding from the foundation, the Hormel Foundation, that also funds some of the research to build an expansion to the laboratory that will be occupied by the Hormel researchers, who are actually researchers and employees of the University of Minnesota, Mayo Clinic, and also some researchers on the Twin Cities campus. It's a great story, and very few people know that great story is in Austin, Minnesota, about 35 miles from Rochester, and closely connected to the Twin Cities. We're really proud of the work that goes on there. Thanks for asking.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to thank you, President Brunix, for being able to highlight what good groundbreaking work they have been doing over the years and how they continue to do that. And it is, I think it's a gem that people aren't aware of. It's just a hidden jewel in the state of Minnesota and throughout the United States and into the world for what it's been doing on cancer research. So thank you for talking about that. And as far as the research dollars, and as you've mentioned, so a portion of the research dollars that you've talked about here, that's including the University of Minnesota Hormel Institute. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative Poppy, the funding, the core funding comes from the University of Minnesota and from the Hormel Foundation. I always get into trouble because I think the family is called Hormel.
Hormel. Mm-hmm, yeah.
And then the company is called Hormel. And so in my radio interviews on my way to the groundbreaking, one of the interviews said, well, can't you make up your mind? Is it Hormel or Hormel? And I had to make this distinction for him. But anyway, it's done that way, and then a good deal of the dollars come from research, and the university gives back to the institute the indirect cost or overhead so it can cover its core infrastructure.
Thank you.
So I'm curious. Now, I never knew anything about this. So the $560-some million that you bring in, that you're going to say you're going to bring in this year in research dollars, does that include the $12 million you
yes.
get from, and does that then bring in more money on federal or whatever these cancer research dollars come in because that $12 million is there to be matched by the Hormel Foundation? Or?
Yeah.
And while I'm at it, how many employees, FTE, that you are down in Austin? I never knew. You've opened up a can.
Mr. Chairman, it's a really good question. This is one of those 13 research centers that are placed in different parts of Minnesota. And when I mentioned the $560 million of expenditures, that's not the awards, but the expenditures. Awards usually run about $20 million more a year. That $12 million is included in the $560. The money that is dedicated from the Hormel Foundation and the university is not booked as part of, you know, that's the contract and grant money that comes in from outside sources. I believe the employees are pretty close to 35-40, if I'm not mistaken. I'm a little hazy on the precise numbers. They're about maybe even more, I guess, but there'd be about 18 or so senior investigators or researchers on site. And then their number of support staff as well. And in many ways, you know, you could ask the same question about the Natural Resources Research Institute north of Duluth, you know, that you know very well. They compete for money, and part of the money they bring in from our internal investment in the state is also a part of this $560 million. And so we're inclined to think that all this activity occurs on the Twin Cities campus, but UMD, for example, is about 5% of the state's total, and is in the aggregate brings in about 4 to 5 times as much as all the other public and private universities in the state. So, I mean, some of this work goes on all over Minnesota, in Rochester, and the Mayo University Partnership, and Hormel, and NRI, and the research stations that are scattered around the state, and it brings a lot of activity, economic activity, into the local communities. And I'd be very happy to share with the committee some analyses we've done to show the economic impact and activity from these investments in the local communities in Minnesota. We've done that breakdown recently.
President Bruner, you know, when I kept reading in your in your budget proposal here about the 90%, which was mentioned several times in there, I was curious as to whether that was on the Twin Cities campus, but it sounds like it's
statewide.
Your other campuses, including Hormel.
Yes, it's the whole statewide University of Minnesota system.
So I had Mr. Gelman, because I was curious as to what that would be with the other top 25 research institutes nationwide, and you keep talking about wanting to be one of the top three, I think, in the world. And John Hopkins is number one in the country, and they only do about 60.6% of the research in Maryland. And when I go down the list, the only close ones to you were the University of Wisconsin at Madison does about 82% of the research in Wisconsin, and about in Seattle, University of Washington in Seattle does about 84. But then the rest of these very, you know, famous institutions like Harvard, 23.5%, or Massachusetts Institute of Technology, 26.7%, Yale, 65.8%. explain to me, at least, maybe the rest of the committee would like to hear, how you got to, it seems what would be a very good monopoly on higher education research in the state of Minnesota, because you're way out of kilter here, and then being the poor capitalist I am, but still, you know, I do believe somewhat in competition, so would it be better to start distributing this maybe to the St. Clouds and Bemidji's and making sure they get a little research just to keep you on your toes, Mr. President? Serious. I'm serious about this because
it seems
you're way out of sync with the rest of the country.
I think Mr. Chairman, I think I can answer your question in a number of ways. Clearly, other campuses do research in Minnesota, and if we have competition, I think that's good for everyone. So I'm not worried about that. What I'm talking about, when you talk about this $560 million, these are dollars we compete for. And the competitive landscape includes mostly institutions around the United States, public and private. Now, what's different about Minnesota, a state of about 5 million people, or slightly south of 5 million people, is that we did not create Washington State and the University of Washington, Iowa State and the University of Iowa. We put our land grant and research institution together. I happen to think that was a very prescient decision, a very smart decision that was made many years ago, particularly for a state of our size. Increasingly, these research enterprises, whether you're talking about foods, animal health, biology, medicine, pharmacy, public health, require pretty significant laboratory investments to stay even and compete. And I do think there are research investments that ought to be made in a number of places throughout the state, and they don't all have to be in the University of Minnesota. But when you're really talking about high technology-intensive investments in this hyper-competitive environment that we're in, I think we have to be very, very smart about how we invest that money. We are not a state of 20 million people with the economy of California, so we have to be very targeted in our investment. We also have to be clear-eyed about where we think we have strengths and comparative advantages in this national scene as well as globally. And I think we're doing that. That's a part of what the university set out to do with its strategic positioning. And I think Minsky has done a great job with its strategic plan and positioning. And we get together and we compare notes about what we're doing and where we're going. We don't see a lot of overlap. We see a lot of complementarity, and I think that's the strength of Minnesota's private and public systems of higher education. But I'd be really planful and thoughtful about putting major research investments in areas that that don't have the core infrastructure to support them. I'll just be honest about that. I think you can really spend a lot of money very, very fast and get very, very low rates of return.
Well, we can maybe have this discussion at another time. But I mean,
it was
a very, you know, interesting to me to see these figures.
Yeah, and I think the reason we're much higher, if you take Michigan, for example, and you use the Michigan statistic, or you use Harvard, and you've got Harvard, MIT, and a lot of big private institutions, Boston U, and they're all very competitive in this area. You go to California, you've got UCLA, you've got Berkeley, you've got Santa Barbara, you've got, you know, a lot of institutions. San Diego is really up and coming, San Francisco. But here, you know, we've tended to concentrate our resources, and I think in a state of this size, I think it's a wise decision, and I think you ought to hold our feet to the fire to work together to make sure that the state investment in public higher education is really working for the benefit of our state and our citizens. But I can tell you, this is not anti-competitive. We are in a very, very competitive environment. If you put an NIH grant in today and you have to be good to even submit it and be competitive to even submit it, you have about a 10% or less chance of getting funded no matter how good you are. So when I talk about Hormel, that's the kind of competitive environment they're in, and that speaks very highly of the kind of success they have.
Thank you. Representative Norton. From yesterday.
Thank you. Chair Rukavina, I would like to ask a question that I don't think has been dealt with, but I see it in the governor's budget, and it's been in the news, and that is reciprocity and the issues surrounding that. Could you address that for us and how it does or does not affect the budget?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, it affects different institutions of higher education differently in Minsku and in the University of Minnesota. The University of Minnesota's tuition rates are somewhat higher. My feeling is when we entered into reciprocity, and actually this represents the joint decision of the House and Senate in a higher education bill that was signed by the governor about 2 years ago, my sense is when we entered into reciprocity, what we were doing is entering into an agreement that we would give our in-state tuition to students from neighboring states who wanted to attend the University of Minnesota or Minsku campuses. That's my understanding of reciprocity. Only in the case of Wisconsin do we have a situation where, get this, where Wisconsin students pay Wisconsin tuition to come to the University of Minnesota, and we have a price difference. And we can argue about why we have the price difference. I'm very comfortable arguing that, and I'd be happy to get into the deep weeds on it. But anyway, they pay their in-state rate. This is an interesting thing. The students who go to Wisconsin don't get the same break. They pay our tuition rates to go to their institution. I think this is absolutely perverse and broken. When it came to the reciprocity agreement with South Dakota, North Dakota, and Manitoba, other neighboring states and, in one case, province, we agreed that they would come here and pay Minnesota rates. Now, in the case of South Dakota and North Dakota, their tuition rates are much lower, but students who come here just, you know, are getting in-state rates. And I think that's the way it should basically work. Well, at the end of the year, you've got tax receipts across the border, and you've got differences in prices, you know, related to higher education, and so Wisconsin and Minnesota sort of get together and they even out the books and the money goes into the general fund. So about 3 years ago, I said, this may be a great way to run an airline, for me to pay $1,000 and for somebody else to pay $250 in the adjacent seat. I mean, I'd argue that, but anyway, I don't think it's a good way to run higher education. And I think the students, when we raise the tuition of Minnesota students on the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus or in Duluth or Morris or Crookston or anywhere else, we should not be asking them to cross-subsidize Minnesota, Wisconsin citizens. So that's what it's basically all about. So about 3 years ago, I sent a letter asking that this be renegotiated on behalf of our board and the University of Minnesota. Our state was reluctant to open it up for a while, but the governor's office and the Department of Finance, under the leadership of Susan Hegarth, agreed to open up the issue. It was decided to defer it until after the election. That is on the Wisconsin side of the border. We were willing to talk about it before the election. We didn't see it as an election issue. And then after the election, Wisconsin decided they didn't want to enter into negotiation. Now they've reconsidered that. And quite honestly, I think this is perverse and it ought to be fixed. And I think the best way to fix it is for Wisconsin students who come here and pay tuition and get their financial aid to do it the same way Minnesota students. And I don't think we should hire six accountants in the Department of Finance to cook all these books each and every year. It ought to be pretty simple. I mean, if the European Union can figure it out, we ought to be able to figure it out between Wisconsin and the University of Minnesota. So that's sort of my position. And you can see there's a little, you can detect there's a little edge to my voice. I've been patient for 3 years asking people to deal with this, and I must say that I take my hat off to Susan Hegarth. She's been a real trooper. She's now going in and trying to negotiate what I think is a fair deal for the University of Minnesota and I think for Minsku institutions. We are not going to retreat from reciprocity. We think it's a really good policy, and we think it's great to have these kids, young people, going across our borders. And so even if we made a change, if we got sort of sick of waiting and we decided to propose a change, we would not propose a change to disrupt reciprocity. And we'd work really hard to make sure we protected the interest of Minnesota kids and Wisconsin kids to participate in our colleges and university at in-state tuition rates. But anyway, that's what it's all about.
So, just to this point, go ahead.
Has the tuition what's the history of the tuition disparity?
The history of Eastland is this: states fund higher education in different ways. For example, I imagine Chancellor McCormick wouldn't mind part of the deal that Wisconsin has. Wisconsin local communities pay local property tax to fund two-year institutions. We used to do that. We decided it was better to fund it on a statewide basis. And so when you look at how funding is done in different states, you have a lot of different formulas. Now, the main comparison is between the Twin Cities and Madison, you know, and the main cost disparity is there. And Wisconsin students pay about $1,500 less a year now. They didn't pay quite so much of a difference, a few years ago, but it's grown to $1,500. Wisconsin recruits many more students from non-reciprocity states, out-of-state students, than we do. About 62% of the students on the Twin Cities campus are Minnesota residents. We think that's good for Minnesota. We like to try to keep Minnesota access as high as we possibly can. But if we were to use the model Wisconsin uses, we'd have a much higher tuition budget because those kids would pay about $20,000 to $21,000 a year. Now, I don't happen to believe that that's a good economic model for higher education in the global economy, and particularly in states that have to grow their educated workforce. I think you're going to probably have some pretty animated discussions about these issues, and we do on our campuses as well. So that's kind of what it is. If you look at the Madison tuition budget and the Twin Cities tuition budget, it's about the same, even though the tuition rate may be $1,500 less a year. And the reason it's made up, you know, basically by Minnesota students going and paying the extra $1,500 and by recruiting students from Illinois or Indiana or Florida or other places at higher rates than we do and then charging them $20,000 to maybe $21,000 a year. So that's the kind of basic difference. But I think we can work this out. I'm an eternal optimist. We should work it out. I mean, we just should level this playing field. It's just silly. It costs us about $7 million a year. Duluth and the university's Twin Cities campus really take a hit on this one.
So, Mr. President Morris, they don't have, do they have a rate, one rate for everybody? How does it work down there?
Mr. Chairman, Morris and Crookston, and I believe a number of the Miskew campuses, Chancellor McCormick can address this better than I, do not have a different rate for in-state and non-reciprocity out-of-state students. And we may have to revisit that for the Twin Cities and Duluth as well. It would cost us a lot of money to move immediately to that rate. But I think if we move to any changes, what we ought to do is assess what the full cost of instruction is. Right now it's about $13,500, and we ought to charge that to out-of-state students. I think that's a better model. But I'm a little uncomfortable asking Minnesota residents to seriously cross-subsidize tuition of students who come from Missouri and other places. If we're going to cross-subsidize, I'd rather have them compete for scholarships and in other forms of aid. That's just my own personal opinion. That the opinions vary widely even on my own campus. So.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You remembered from the last meeting. I appreciate that. I did have a question.
I'm not getting bad yet. I mean, I've got Iron Range Alzheimer's. I'm forgetting everything but the grudges. But you know, other than that, my mind's working pretty good yet.
I hope this memory lapse lasts for about a half an hour more.
I did have a question that was lingering from the last time, and that had to do with how the university is doing with our underrepresented students. I guess I was looking at the Minsky document, that's what they call them. You know who I mean. I'm talking about the students, for example. I know in Minneapolis, where I represent, we have some pretty difficult graduation statistics with, for example, I know the Latino community, I think it's about 35% graduation. I think 1% get into college. And I think that's in the Minsky system. I don't know what the number is at the university system. I'd like to know if you know and what you might be doing to try to bring in these kinds of students. I mean, doing away with general college was a major step towards reversing that, what I'm talking about. But I'm thinking, American Indian students, African American students, we have, certainly have various groups in the new immigrant community, some of whom do very well and others who aren't doing well at all. So I'm just wondering
what you can tell us about where you're going with that, and sure. either tell us some good things, or maybe, I don't see any investment in this numbers. I was trying to look, maybe I missed it. Maybe there's something in here that's really great.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, I'm pleased to answer this question. I'm a little worried that Representative Mahoney may give me the hook, because I'd like to talk about this one for about an hour. But anyway, let me just address it this way. We place a very, very high value in recruiting first-generation college students, students from diverse cultural backgrounds, people who are from new immigrant families, and I think the University of Minnesota, and I would argue Minsku, really do, I think, a phenomenal job in this area. You mentioned General College, and I understand there's some controversy about that. I'd be happy to meet with you separately, but that was not a step back. In fact, if you look at the entering characteristics of the students on the Twin Cities campus today, they're more diverse now than they were 2 years ago. And the students are better prepared, and they're making more progress towards graduation. And the faculty in General College in a newly formed department are providing academic support to the students who need it. We've tried to deal with these issues, and I think they're very serious issues for Minnesota, and particularly for our great urban centers, and some areas of greater Minnesota as well, in a number of ways. We started something called the Consortium on Post-Secondary Success. Chancellor McCormick, the Commissioner of Education, and I started something called the P16 Partnership, where we bring all the leaders of K-12 and higher education, including the private sector, together to deal with these issues on a regular basis. Our separate systems, in different ways, have tried to address the rising cost of higher education. We started something called the Founders Opportunity Free Tuition Program. That, in part, is in this budget. When we talk about advancing education, we're asking the state to join with us to provide some modest investment in that area that we're going to go out and multiply two or three times more through private gifts and contributions. So one of the things that does is it provides a free tuition scholarship for Pell-eligible students. Our best estimate, based on the cohorts of students who are in this program today, is that about 30% of these students are students of color, from very diverse cultural backgrounds, and their family income is roughly $26,000 a year. So that eventually is going to cover 5,000 students on the campuses of the University of Minnesota. So we're really working on the financial end. We're also taking this K-12 consortium into partnership with the K-12 system and trying to get resources aligned across institutions of higher education to help young people get better prepared so they can be successful in our colleges and universities. And I would argue that some of the best partnerships are with the city of Minneapolis and the Minneapolis public schools. The other thing we've done that I think is good, and Chancellor McCormick, I'm sure, will talk about this in the Power of You program. It's a very inspiring program developed by the community college system in the metropolitan area. The other thing we've tried to do is to get people interested in investing in these urban schools and investing in young people who have the prospects to go to higher education. So you have the Wallen Scholarship Program, you have the McGuire Scholarship Program. It brings a lot of new money in to provide young people opportunities to go to higher education. In the case of the Wallen and McGuire Program, these young people are on the dean's list at very high rates. They get lots of academic support when they make the transition to the University of Minnesota. We're also starting some summer bridge programs that we think are very exciting. A lot of young people start our colleges and universities and don't make it very far. And we think part of that has to do with not getting an early start and a good start. There's a lot of research that demonstrates that or suggests that if you do this well, and kids get a good start in the first semester, their rates of success go up dramatically. So we're trying to learn from our experience. We're trying to put new financial supports in place, and engaging in new academic partnerships that we think will really make a difference. But we do have our challenges, and we have to acknowledge they're there, and we have to work together across K-12 and higher education to make a difference. And I think we're making some real progress in this. The record at the University of Minnesota is a very positive one when you look at the diversity of our student population. Last year, the entering freshman class was comprised of 20% of students from very diverse cultural backgrounds, students of color who entered the University of Minnesota for the first time. I should also say one other quick thing. I'll just make this really quick. The University of Morris has, in my judgment, the best program of access to higher education for Native American students that you will find anywhere in the world. There are now 170 of these young people who go on tuition-free scholarships negotiated in a treaty, I think in the 1880s or 1890s. The university pays for that, and it's been a struggle because the numbers were at one time 50, and now they're at 170 because young people all over the United States know that this is a great place to study, and they know about this tuition scholarship program. We've tried to get the federal government to help us with this unfunded mandate, and we're making some modest success, and I hope we can get them to step up and help support what I think is probably one of the best programs that I've ever heard of anywhere in the world.
Representative Clark.
Are you requesting, or did you request then, additional resources for any of these programs?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, in two areas, in the main area is advancing education. There are a number of innovations in there to improve access and support for low-income students. Also, academic programs to really help them succeed. We have already funded through the last appropriation for the Minnesota Legislature, the Consortium on Post-Secondary Success. Kent Pakal is our new director. He was one of the chief assistants in the St. Paul schools under Superintendent Harvey. So there has been state support. I mean, you helped us last time. We've raised private money to help support that initiative. There's also money in this budget and in this request that we think is important. That was one area that the governor did not recommend in his recommendation to you.
So let me, Mr. Chairman, if I could just be
sure.
Clear on that. So you recommended to the governor, but he did not recommend it to us, additional research.
Yes, some investments on advancing education that clearly includes support for many of the things we've just been discussing.
Thank you.
And some other things.
Representative Briner.
Mr. Chair, President Brunix, my question is on the competitive compensation dollars. Yesterday, you spoke to us about their purpose, but I'm wondering about their oversight and the decision-making process and their use.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Briner, this is a very rigorous process. We index this money only goes to academic fields that are under extraordinary pressure in a nationally competitive or internationally competitive market. So it first starts with a lot of analysis. First of all, our salaries generally are very, very low in the bottom third of the best 30 universities in the country. But we're really targeting this money in areas where our market competition is fierce and where the disparity is basically the greatest. So it starts with market analyses and careful research that's done in the office of the Academic Vice President and Provost of the University of Minnesota, Tom Sullivan, who is here today. It involves meetings with all the deans where they have to really present their case and make their arguments. When the allocations are done, it goes to roughly 5 to 10% of the faculty on the campuses to try to keep, I believe it's 5 to 10%, Tom, to keep their salary and compensation up to very competitive levels. But it's a very rigorous process. We implemented it about 2 years ago. We see this as a multi-year strategy. It'll take about 4 to 6 years, I think, to put ourselves in a much better position. I think we have to be patient, but we need to start making these down payments to keep the university competitive and strong, and we're determined to find some way to do it. And we're asking for, I think, some modest help from you, and we're going to do some of the heavy lifting ourselves.
Okay, any other questions from the committee? If not, I do have one last one, President. We, in hearing from the students, whether it was in your system or in the Minsky system, textbooks was a big concern. And I know, I think, there was some legislation even, isn't there, some report that's supposed to be due by to the legislature, but what are you doing? Because the concerns were the cost, the fact that they, you know, moved a few chapters around, they were required to get a new book. Couldn't they have books, more books in the library when you negotiate with the publishers for this? And there were a number of questions brought up on it and maybe solutions, putting it on online or whatever. What's the university doing to try to correct this?
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is increasingly a difficult problem, and I think we're doing a number of things, but we need to do, frankly, much better. Part of this is exacerbated by, really, the consolidations occurring in the publishing industry and the changes in publishing practice. There is more content online now, and so when you produce a textbook, fewer copies are sold. That tends to drive up prices. Also, there's more concentration of distribution in fewer places, so that tends to drive down competition and increase cost. A lot of the textbooks are being produced by international companies at the present time. So we're doing a number of things. We try to, first of all, drive down the cost. In our bookstore, for example, on the Twin Cities campus, we try to cross-subsidize textbooks to some extent through clothing sales and other things that make some profit on campus. Secondly, we have a very active used book sale program. The problem is if somebody changes the book, then of course, you know, some of your students are telling you, I paid $20, I take it in, I try to sell it, and the new edition comes out and the thing's worth 5 cents. That's a part of what's going on here now too. But it is a problem, and more faculty are working hard to put more and more materials online to try to drive down the cost. And we're trying to get more into buying cooperatives. That's really helped a lot with the library initiative and the CIC, which is the Big Ten in the University of Chicago. We save millions of dollars every year by trying to build a buying cooperative, and then by doing that, driving down the cost of purchases. So I think we need to do a number of things like that. I think it's a good question for you to ask, and I think it's a good challenge for us to confront, because these costs have been going up at double-digit rates in our libraries and for our students, and we have to find ways to restrain the growth of these costs, because it makes, you know, I talked to a student the other day whose textbooks, and this was a student in the Institute of Technology, in that particular course, he was taking about 18 credits, were pretty close to $400. And when I talk about a 4.5% tuition increase as a part of our core budget, I estimate that cost to be about $350. So you can get a sense for what these impacts are. And I just think we need to work together, and we need to work resourcefully and creatively to find a number of ways. I don't think there's one solution, but I think there are a variety of solutions that would help us drive these costs down. We need to work on it.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, President Brooks. One of the questions, I have two questions. One just in relation to the book issue here. I think one of the things, I've got one that's just finished college, the other one is getting ready to come back home and start college again. And I think one of the issues is what their frustrations have been trying to sell their books, because of the editions are keep changing, the professors keep requiring newer editions, that whole, and I'm wondering what the university's view would be on putting some sort of moratorium, or just saying, look, if you're going to use this book, you have to use it for 3 or 4 years. The second question I have is pertaining to failure rates, or rates of students who drop out after their first year of college. First through failure, second through those who just do not return. What kind of numbers or percentages, and if you have those by chance? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Severson, let me try the first question. I think this is complicated in a lot of ways. It's very hard to tell a professor, you know, what to use in his or her class. But I do think we have to have a serious conversation on our campuses to see if we can, not exactly regulate, but at least try to make people much more sensitive to the impact of these changes on the economic lives of our students. And so we are starting those conversations, and I think it's good to... One of the things we do at the university, this is an aside here, but it's very relevant to your question, we not only track tuition, we try to track the total cost of attendance and work hard to drive down the total number as well as the tuition rate. So last year, for example, through a whole number of internal changes we made at the university. We were able to drive down, parking and transport. We cross-subsidized public transportation so that the students can do that through the parking program, incidentally. So if you want to drive your car, you pay more, and we put some of it into public transit. And we also were able to drive down food costs and housing costs and that sort of thing. So I think you have to look at that total cost, because that's what you get hit with as a parent and as a family. We are really concerned about what you characterize as retention and student progress and graduation rate. And we've had a number of studies at the University of Minnesota to see what is going on, to try to figure out how to make sure when we admit students that they are successful at the University of Minnesota. So the Summer Bridge program for kids who need this kind of help and support as they make the transition to college and university life is one of those strategies. Rethinking the academic support systems is really important. We find that the measures of mid-semester progress in the first semester of your enrollment are the most predictive measure of all of whether you're going to succeed, stay the second year, and actually graduate from a college or university. So we're really working on those issues. We're really raising our graduation rate expectations. We're asking everybody on all the campuses of the University of Minnesota to look at everything from A to Z to see what we can do to work together to help students become more successful. These rates are improving, and I think they have to. I think we need to really hold our feet to the fire. We found, for example, in one of our studies, and I'm not particularly proud of this, to be honest with you, on the Twin Cities campus, that 7.5% of our students in the last several years were leaving with over 100 credits and not graduating. Now, they may have gone up the road to St. Cloud or some other place to graduate, which is a good thing. We don't capture that in the accounting systems, unfortunately, in our state or in the national accounting system. But 7.5% is way too high. Especially to 100 credits, you're within 15% of finishing the thing off if you think about the requirements. And so Provost Tom Sullivan and Senior Vice President Jones, who works with the coordinate campuses, are really going after these issues to see if we can really help the students get much more successful. Some colleges and universities have used some electronic learning strategies to try to help students complete who are out on jobs. And so it's a good question. To me, if students are more successful, the state succeeds, we can serve more students with the same money. I mean, we can keep costs down. When you have high attrition rates in business, in higher education, in schools, it costs more. And you get poorer results. And so I think you put your finger on a really important responsibility that I think we all share and we need to do something about. And the good news is it's getting a lot better. But as they say in the service industry, good enough is not good enough. I think we need to be much better than we are today.
Representative Devereux, did you have any final question here?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. President Brunick, in terms of budget, is your athletic budget revenues, is that separate from your general fund?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Detmer, yes, the athletic revenues are completely separate. The University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus, all the campuses provide some internal money to support athletics, and the Twin Cities campus, it's around $5 to $6 million a year, and much of that was given to the university by the state legislature some years ago as an investment in Title IX, and to help expand opportunities for young women on our campus. So we do not have a lot of subsidy. The athletic budget will probably be on the Twin Cities campus close to $60 million this year. And only about $5 million of that comes from internal resources, and it's mostly targeted on helping to support non-revenue sports and women's intercollegiate athletics.
Okay. Thank you very much. An interesting, and I think we've got some serious decisions to make, and hopefully we can keep the students in mind when we're making it. So thank you, Mr. President.
We need to do that, and I look forward to working with the committee along with my colleagues and getting a really good result. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Chancellor McCormick, welcome. And I don't know if some folks coming up with you as
Well, you can introduce, I guess, the rest of the members who will be sitting with you. Welcome, Councilman McCormick. Nice to see you. I haven't seen you for a while.
Thank you very much, Chair Rukavina and committee members. For the record, my name is Jim McCormick, and I'm privileged to serve as Chancellor of the Minnesota State College and Universities. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with the committee today about our budget request. And with me is Trustee David Patch, the Chair of the Board of Trustees. Before I begin, though, our formal presentation, I'd like to share with the committee an exciting event that I attended in Alexandria this last Saturday morning. It was a family reintegration academy for National Guard families who will have family members returning from Iraq this summer or fall. What a moving experience. About 100 family members, husbands, wives, mothers, fathers from the Alexandria area attended the academy to learn about the issues they will likely face once the family members return and the resources that we have in the state, not just the college and university system, but the resources that we have to be helpful. Now, this is just one of 10 such sessions being conducted around the state on our campuses. One is not there, but the rest of them are. There'll be another 20 sessions scheduled when the National Guard troops return. And the Minnesota State College Universities, and this is just an example, many things, I could give you many examples, are playing a major role in these sessions. We're serving as hosts and providing information about educational resources available for returning veterans. One family said to me, it's so nice to come to a college in this environment rather than a cold armory or with the chairs on the floor. The National Guard Adjutant General Larry Shalalto, the former president of Alexandria Tech, is a national advocate for reintegration services, and I just want you to know that he gave the system, the colleges and universities, an award for the work we're doing with the veterans. And I'm just very proud of the way in which the colleges and universities have stepped up to the plate in making these difficult transitions. And it's just one way in which we're involved all over the state of Minnesota. I believe we have three presidents, or four with me here today. I don't want to miss anyone. Dr. Quistgaard is here, in leadership, Cheryl, Frank, and Kathy Brown, I think you're here, and okay, thank you very much. Anybody else that I'm missing, Mary? Okay, thank you so much. All of our presidents were in yesterday, and all of this budget material they've been part of, and they wanted to have a few representatives here today. Mr. Chair and members, the legislature, we built our budget on your principles, and I want to show you how this fits together when we come to what we need and how it's based on what's been going on. The legislature has long recognized the importance of higher education to our state, has articulated these objectives for the state's investment in higher education, and we, as a state publicly owned college and university system, we've looked at what you said that we need to do. They're stated in Minnesota statutes, and they talk about ensuring quality, fostering student success, promoting democratic values, maintaining access, and enhancing the economy. These objectives carry through our strategic plan, and that you'll hear about, which we built our budget request on, and you'll see how it flows together. Now, we are requesting funds that will enable the Minnesota State College and Universities to better meet the challenges facing Minnesota and the nation. Now, you've all been reading, we all have, the national and state reports that are urgently calling for more college graduates and more high-skilled workers to meet the demands of this global economy and fill the positions that are being vacated by a wave of retirements in many fields. Now, our publication, Educating Minnesota, Meeting the Challenge, includes references to many of these reports. Our system's 7 state universities and 25 community and technical colleges play a big role in meeting these challenges. We educate more than 370,000 students annually in credit and non-credit courses, or about 64% of all Minnesota undergraduates. Every year we graduate more than 33,000 students, and more than 80% of them, and I'm very proud of this, stay in Minnesota to work or continue their education. So this is investment in the people of Minnesota who stay here to contribute to the economic vitality and the quality of life in this state. The state's investment in the Minnesota State College and University produces significant benefits for the economy and quality of life. I could go on with a long list, but our graduates contribute to the vitality of communities across the state in many ways. 80% of the state's new nursing graduates, 53% of the new teachers, 92% of the state's law enforcement officers, to name just a few. Clearly, this organization, owned by the people of Minnesota, which you have supported, we educate Minnesota and we make it work. We're also proud of to offer the most accessible higher education in the state. The 32 colleges and universities are located on 53 campuses in 46 communities across the state. In addition, our college and universities serve more students of color than any other higher education provider in the state. In 2006, we enrolled about 29,800 students of color, making up 14% of our total headcount enrollment in credit courses. We also offer the most affordable higher education in the state. Our tuition averages about $4,100 this year. But students are paying, and this is one of my most important points, and I think you've been hearing this from our students too, students are paying 88% more than they did in 2000. These increases were triggered largely by cuts in state funding during that period, and today our system receives 23% less state funding per full-time equivalent student than in 2000 in inflation-adjusted dollars. We have been very, very concerned about the burden that this has placed on our students. And we are presenting a budget request that calls for an average 4% increase in tuition per year, the lowest since 1999, and for students that amounts in our system to an average tuition increase of $165 a year. In fact, the board feels so strongly about this that we indicated that this was a powerful discussion at the board, a long-time discussion with students. The board indicated that it was our intention to have the tuition increases held to 4%, a cap of 4%, even if our budget request is not fully funded. This would mean that the difference would have to come from cuts or in other areas, which also could affect students, probably would. So our hope is, and our great passion in terms of our presentation is, that the legislature will be able to fund us at a level close to our request, as close as possible. One of the fastest growing areas in our organization is online education. Courses offered over the internet enable many students to gain a college education who otherwise might not be able to attend because they cannot move to a campus or fit traditional classes into their busy work or family schedules. We have a number of older students, single-parent moms that are trying to get an advance in their degree to get jobs, are able to use this, plus our students on the campuses as well. Now, online education has grown dramatically. From 2003 to 2006, the number of students enrolled in our online credit courses more than doubled, from 16,000 to 40,000 a year. However, this remarkable growth presents a challenge because it adds to the demands of our technology infrastructure, and we'll be telling you more about that later. Our budget request reflects the strategic priorities. Based on that mandate, the early legislation, the strategic priorities set by the 15 members of the Board of Trustees. And now I'm going to turn to Chair Paskatz, the chair of our board, to introduce the budget request. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, and good afternoon, Chair Rukavina and members of the committee. As Chancellor McCormick indicated, the budget request has its roots in the four-year strategic plan for the system that the Board of Trustees adopted early last year. Through an inclusive and thoughtful process, the Board developed four strategic directions, and we are very committed to carrying them out. I'm just going to go over them briefly. The first strategic direction calls for increasing access and opportunity. This means raising Minnesota's participation and achievement in post-secondary education. Too many students today do not see college as a viable option, and we are very serious about turning that situation around in measurable numbers. This will require keeping college affordable and working more closely with the K-12 schools to find ways to better prepare our students for college. This also will require us to greatly expand the services that help many students succeed in college, things such as tutoring, counseling, academic enrichment, and guidance on financial aid. Strategic direction number 2 calls for promoting and measuring high-quality learning programs and services. We aim to prove that our academic programs and student services meet high standards for quality, that our graduates have strong and adaptable skills for the 21st century, and that our courses are taught in the most effective way possible for multiple learning styles and student needs. The third strategic direction calls for providing programs and services integral to state and regional economic needs, which plays out in various ways, including identifying and meeting regional and statewide economic development priorities, contributing cultural and civic assets that attract people to all of our communities, and becoming more engaged in the work of local organizations. Our fourth strategic direction is probably the most significant, because we are placing a real emphasis on innovation. It calls for finding innovative ways to provide educational programs and student services, to reward and support institutions, administrators, faculty, and staff for innovations that advance excellence and efficiency, and to identify and remove barriers to innovation and responsiveness. The Board of Trustees believes the system's request for $177 million in additional funds is critical for meeting our strategic goals and enabling the system to make strong contributions toward meeting Minnesota's challenges. The Board began the process of developing its biannual budget request for 2008-2009 nearly a year ago by discussing the strategic plan goals and the accompanying action plan that the Board adopted. 3 work groups were formed that were made up of the faculty bargaining unit representatives, student association representatives, staff from the colleges and universities, and others affected by the budget request. These work groups were asked to develop budget recommendations centered on the 4 strategic goals in meetings held throughout the summer. The college and university presidents were invited to come forward with ideas and were actively involved in shaping the budget request recommended to the chancellor last fall. Preliminary budget recommendations were reviewed by the Leadership Council, and that's the group composed of all 32 college and university presidents plus the members of the chancellor's cabinet. In September, the board's Finance and Facilities Committee reviewed the biannual operating budget request and held a public hearing on it. In November, the full Board of Trustees approved the budget request, which includes an assumption, as Chancellor McCormick was saying, that tuition will rise by an average of no more than 4% per year across the system. The board feels very strongly that students cannot continue to carry the burden of sharply escalating tuition. We recognize that not everyone agrees with the board's decision, but we believe this request represents a good balance between the desire to keep tuition as low as possible and the needs of the colleges and universities for resources to enable them to deliver high-quality programs and services, and really to achieve the strategic direction that we've set for ourselves. With that, I'll turn it back to you, Chancellor McCormick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I also want to acknowledge Dr. Catherine Jeffries, the president of Hampton Tech, and the president of our assistant to the cabinet. Now, the $177 million biennial budget increase approved by the board is summarized on page 2 of the document. And Mr. Chair and members, this concludes our part of the presentation, but we intend to be here and expect to be back for questions. But we're a team effort at our organization, and I'd like now, if it's agreeable with you, to have members of our staff lead into some detail about the budget, and then we can be available for the questions as you wish, if that would be possible.
Chancellor, that's fine with me, Duke. Do any of the other members have any questions for these two, or do you want to represent this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor McCormick, I just want to take this opportunity. You opened with a great slide there. Last year, this legislature put into effect the campus liaison rep that really puts veterans on the campuses, that acts as an interface between the faculty and the campus itself, to when vets come back, they have a place that they can go and they can learn where they get the benefits, how to best utilize those benefits, and how to interface on a campus. And MNSCU has been tremendous in implementing this program. It was partially funded kind of as a pilot program, and it's in the governor's bill again this year for future funding for the 26 that are coming home. So I just want to say thanks so much for all of your work on that. And it's been a model program for the nation, and I really appreciate the taking that bull by the horns and going forward with it.
Thank you. We really believe that it's part of our mission in serving Minnesotans. Thank you so much. And we'll just step back and have our colleagues come out, Mr. Chair, if that's agreeable.
That's fine with me.
Thank you.
Ms. King, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr.
It's a pleasure to have you in front of the committee again.
It's a pleasure to be
chair.
Here with you this afternoon. Thank you so much. My name is Laura King, and I'm the Vice Chancellor and Chief Financial Officer for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. And I'm joined by Ken Neamey, who is our Vice Chancellor for Information Services and Chief Information Officer, and Linda Baer, who's the Senior Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs. We're going to work our way through the slides here, a little bit of a tag team effort, and then we'll, as you wish, Mr. Chair, respond to questions or otherwise.
Go ahead.
Welcome,
all three.
Thank you very much. I'm going to lead off with a overview of the budget request. You should all have in your folders a book that looks like this, and you're certainly invited to follow along as we go. We'll work our way through the book in pretty good fashion. We'll also be joined by a couple of campus folks as we move through the presentation. So hopefully we'll have lots of good information for you here today. As the Chancellor indicated, our request is for a $177 million increase in state support for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and that increase is structured really in two primary strategic packages. The first is titled Strategic Advancements and has to do, as Representative Clark inquired earlier, a very significant emphasis on our part to improving services that we're titling Access, Opportunity, and Success, and Vice Chancellor Barrow will speak at length about that. Also in the strategic advancements proposal is a group of activities we're calling academic innovations, which follow on in large part to things that this body has supported in the past, resources for centers of excellence, resources for investment in science, technology, engineering, and math programming, and resources for healthcare education. The second primary objective here is resources for infrastructure. And like the university, it was interesting to us when we got all done and we looked at our proposals side by side, we seemed to be having some sort of a shared brainwave, because they also use this language and they talk about it in much the same way. It has to do both with our technology infrastructure and our human infrastructure. Resources for investments in our operating cost inflation, compensation cost improvements, and improvements in a very significant way in our technology infrastructure. So that's the big picture. $177 million, two primary strategic packages, one focused on academic programming and the other focused on infrastructure requirements to support the overall system. I want to give a little bit of a history lesson here for members that are new to the Higher Ed Committee, are new to the Higher Ed topic. When we talk about support for higher education in our system, we measure it in dollars per student, which is our full year equivalent measure. We take all the credits that we sell, we put them into groups of 30, we call that a full year equivalent customer, and then we compare the dollars per full year equivalent. And what you see on this chart is from fiscal 2000 to fiscal 2007, once you consider the effects of inflation, which are a real and present condition when so much of your business is labor costs, that our support per student has risen, if you don't consider inflation, it's risen about 3% a year, and if you do consider inflation, it's risen at less than 2%. So we have been very flat in resources per student over the last 7 years. Now you might be thinking this doesn't make any sense because you've been hearing all the stories about tuition increases, And it's absolutely the case that we've had extraordinary tuition increases over this same period. What we've had, though, is a tuition dollar replacing a state dollar. Our educational activities, unlike the University of Minnesota, which has a much more diverse revenue mix, our activities are funded to a very large extent, either by state appropriation or tuition. That is the bulk of our support. And so when state appropriation goes down, we have really no place to go but to tuition. Mm-hmm. And we have had to go there over the last 7 years in a very strong way. And the result has kept us about par in total dollars available. But we've switched a green dollar for a blue dollar. And you can see that in this chart. State appropriation per FYE has declined 8% over the last 7 years, while tuition per FYE has gone up 88%. But overall, resources have gone up very moderately. And that's the dynamic of what's been going on for us. If you look at our overall budget, we have a base appropriation in state support of $1.2 billion expected for the 2008-09 biennium, and our request is for a $177 million increase for a new base appropriation of $1.381 billion. We would also pledge then to contribute to the financing of education, an increase in tuition. The Chancellor indicated 4% is the position our board has taken. That would translate into $73 million in additional resources in the coming biennium. 4% a year per student, then at about $167 per student, with the number of students we have, translates into $73 million for the biennium. In addition, we've identified $25 million in existing resources internally that we would redirect, and we'll talk as we go through the presentation about how we plan on targeting those resources to particular objectives. You have heard about the tuition increases, and just to put you back into a little more history, in fiscal 2004, we raised tuition 13.6%. In fiscal 2005, we raised it 13.8%. 2006, it was 6.1%. In 6.1%. In 2007, it was 7.2%. So we have had a steady march of tuition increases. At the same time, our state support in the same time period went down 7% and then up 6%. So we're about even in state support over the last 4 years while we've had a substantial increase in enrollment. To drill a little deeper into the budget request, and you'll see this on the inside cover of your book if you want to follow along, strategic advancements, $50 million request for the biennium, and that breaks into $24 million for Access and Opportunity and Success Initiative and $26 million for Academic Innovations. Infrastructure, the request here is $127 million for the biennium, and that breaks pretty evenly at $70 million for technology and $57 million for inflation. Tuition assumption, $73 million, and reallocations at $25 million. We'll go into each one of these with some detail, so you won't get a lot of detail from me about the specific measures and objectives and outcomes for each of the initiatives at this juncture. I just want to give you the basic overview. The other thing I want to mention is that for as many years as I've been involved, when we've approached the question of inflation and our compensation cost increases, we've applied the principle that was in statute that holds that it's the state's expectation that students pay for a third of their cost of education and that the public generally pay for two-thirds of the cost. So we apply that when we think about how to pay for compensation cost increases. Our tuition increase, the additional revenue, would be directed right at compensation cost increases. And with the state support for the other $57 million then, we would be able to cover what have been the guidelines for inflation. But when you see inflation on this sheet, just know that our cost is that number at $57 million plus another $73, which we would turn to the students through a tuition increase and ask their support for. You see on the next slide Another way to illustrate the exchange we've had going on between state support and tuition support over the last 7 or 8 years.